The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
My first impression of the Shroud, then, is that on the face of it, it would make sense to dismiss it as medieval forgery. But as I'm about to discover, there is more, a great deal more to this cloth than meets the eye.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, happy Easter. So good to be with you today, taking a look at the resurrection of Jesus Christ. What evidence do we have? Why did he rise from the dead? Do you really believe it? Is there evidence that points to that? If you missed any part of the conversation today, we've been diving into various aspects of the resurrection. Just go to relevantradio.com, go to the podcast for the show, and you'll be able to hear some great conversation earlier today with Monsignor Charles Pope talking about what Christ did after he died on the cross, as he descended to the dead, to the resurrection, to his post, to his, well, his resurrection encounters with everyone from Mary Magdalene to the apostles. And of course, we looked at the evidence, both historically and in Scripture, that points to the resurrection. But there's one other thing. There's another aspect of the story that I don't think is as strong as some of the other proofs that we talked about, but it's one that I personally believe in. It's somewhat subjective, and that is the burial cloth of Jesus Christ. The only one I'm aware of that ever showed a man who had been beaten, who had been scourged, who had been crowned, who had been crucified, who had been wrapped in that garment and placed in a tomb. I personally believe, this is me personally, I believe that the Shroud of Turin is the burial cloth of Jesus Christ. There's a lot of controversy over whether or not it is. There was some carbon 14 dating done years ago that indicated, oh, it's a medieval forgery, but experts later said, no, that was an error. They took a piece of the shroud that had been exposed to a fire. The carbon dating was skewed. So is the Shroud of Turin a snapshot of the resurrection? Why does Scripture tell us that there was a burial cloth rolled up and in a separate place? You know, St. John's Gospel, if you think about it, if you read that, it specifies a really curious detail when it recounts the story of the resurrection. You know, Scripture tells us that when Simon Peter arrived after John, right, John outran him, he went into the tomb and he saw the burial cloth there. And the cloth that covered Jesus' head, not with the burial cloth, but rolled up in a separate place. Why would John have noted the placement of the burial cloth in light of this astonishing fact that Jesus was gone, his body was missing? Well, why do you mention what the, you know, there were garments there, right? Why would it be thought that important to include? I'm struck by that. You know, why that detail in the telling of the events of the first Easter morning? I want to take a look at that because, you know, again, we go back to what scientists say. And let's get to the heart of the matter of this. I mean, if you're not familiar with the Shroud, by the way, and we're going to talk about this, you're more than welcome to join me. The number, 888-914-9149. Call in with your questions, your comments, and join the conversation. If you're not familiar with what the Shroud is, it's a length of linen. Right? We'll talk about this throughout the day. It has an image of what looks like a very strong, tall, bearded man. And, you know, he looks very much like older paintings of Jesus before, you know, artists began to modify them. It's in negative. Only when the camera was invented in, like, the 19th century did it unlock another secret. Did it begin to reveal details of its features that, you know, for centuries remained hidden. And, of course, scientists debate a lot of the technicalities regarding the Shroud, but there's one that really stands out to me. Nobody can explain how this image got on the cloth in the first place. How did it get on there? You know, nobody's been able to replicate this, duplicate it. Even with modern technology, experts say it's impossible to inflect such an image on such an imperfect fabric. You got to remember the fabric it was made of. It's done in a way that displays zero use of pigments, no type of artistic substance. It's not distorted in any way. You couldn't do an image with a laser without scientists detecting the technique. And yet this has been around for centuries before the invention of the camera or any of those techniques. The image is just there. So let's talk about it, too. There's even a Divine Mercy connection, too, to this. And I write about this in my book, The Shroud and Divine Mercy. And maybe I'll get to that either later in the show today or maybe later in the week. But I want to welcome to the broadcast a longtime friend of the show. And I've spoken to him many times across the years regarding the Shroud of Turin. And that's Rush Briault. He's been researching and lecturing on this incredible, I think, gift from heaven for over 30 years, this incredible document of the Lord's resurrection. And if you have the opportunity to hear him speak, you'll love him. He's captivated audiences from New York to Hawaii. And if you want to learn more, just go to shroudencounter.com. That's his website, shroudencounter.com. Russ, happy Easter. It's good to have you back. Good afternoon.
Hey, Drew, so glad to be back with you again, and happy Easter as well.
Happy Easter to you, too. So let's go through this. I mean, there's so much to talk about. Let's start with what the scriptures tell us. This garment was actually talked about in that gospel account. Let's start there and take us through the shroud. What do we know about it? How did the image get on there? What's it reveal? There's a lot to get into.
Yeah, well, actually, all four Gospels talk about the linen cloth that Jesus was wrapped in. The one that is used the most is the narrative found in the Gospel of John. And the story goes is that Mary Magdalene is going to the tomb on Sunday morning and sees that the stone is rolled aside from the entrance, and she peeks in, sees that the body's gone, and runs to find the apostles. And so Peter and John, now her first reaction is that someone has taken or stolen the body. So Peter and John run back down to the tomb. And as you said in your intro, that John gets there first and waits for slowpoke Peter. And, and finally, Peter gets there and goes straight on inside the tomb. And John follows him inside the tomb. And they see the linen cloth lying there. And Peter's not so sure what he saw, because in the Gospel of Luke, it says he kind of walks away wondering. But John seems to know exactly what he saw, because in John's Gospel, it says John saw and believed. Yeah. And believed what? Well, believed that he rose again. He may not have understood resurrection, but he knew what he was looking at was not a cloth that had been, was not something that was evidence of a theft, but rather evidence of a miracle. And it's... So, you know, I think it's really, really important to ask this question when it comes to the shroud, because there are, you know, there's lots of people that say, well, you know, it's just got to be some kind of a medieval fake or forgery or whatever. But, you know, I asked myself this question. Was the linen cloth lying there, which became the first piece of evidence causing John to believe in the resurrection? He was the first one to believe in the resurrection based on that evidence. Was it only meant for Peter and John, or was it meant for the whole world throughout all generations? I mean, that's a big question. Was it only meant for Peter and John, or was it meant for the whole world? And that's the exact same cloth that's in Turin, Italy right now. And understanding how God works, I can't imagine that it was only meant for Peter and John.
Yeah, no, I could not agree with you more. I think it's a gift for all believers in Jesus Christ. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, things that point to the proof of the resurrection. But this, like the image of Guadalupe, you know, has seemed to survive time. It has, should have decayed or been destroyed, should have been lost. And yet there's a mystery to the image itself. You know, I know they did carbon-14 dating on it in 1988, and that came back, and it really has created a lot of confusion over whether or not this dates back to the time of Jesus Christ. Let's clear up, you know, one of the greatest, I think, attacks on the shroud and one of the greatest misconceptions of our day regarding whether or not this even dates back to the burial of Jesus.
Well, they did carbon date it in 1988, as you said, and of course they violated the sampling protocol that had been established. For instead of taking three different samples from three different locations, they took one sample from the outside corner edge, exactly where it had been held and handled and held up for public veneration for literally hundreds of times. In fact, that we can document from 1418 to 1694, it was exhibited exactly that way, with people holding on to that precise corner 275 times. And so it stands to reason that if you are looking for the most possible, the worst possible sample location, the sample that was most likely contaminated or repaired, then you'd pick from the corner that had been held and handled 275 times. Right. And of course, I always ask people, how many of you know that cutting one sample into three sections is not the same as taking three different samples? And it's so now the most significant carbon dating event of the 20th century now hinges on one questionable sample. And now it appears that chemical research has shown that this was published in a peer-reviewed journal in 2005, that corner appears to have been subjected to some kind of a medieval reweave or some kind of a repair. And so do we even know what we dated? And so I think at this point, all we can really say about carbon dating is that it's inconclusive because they took a lousy sample, and that sample may not even be entirely of the original shroud in the first place. I've been drawn recently to historical references that are really, really important, because back in after the carbon date came out with the date range of 1260 to 1390, mm-hmm. It seemed to be a slam dunk, is because the shroud first appears in Luray, France. Its first appearance in Western Europe in 1356, and it's owned by a very honorable knight. His name is Geoffrey de Charnay. Well, 1356 falls right within that date range of 1260 to 1390, so aha, see, it must be a fake. I mean, Geoffrey must have fabricated it somehow, some way, in the mid-1300s. There you go. And they didn't look any further, because they felt that they had found their link that corroborated the medieval carbon date. Well, you see, now we've had 30 years of additional historical research, and now we know for a fact that the shroud was in Constantinople in 1204 and stolen during the Fourth Crusade, and goes underground for a while, and then eventually reappears in France in 1356. Well, this is really, really important, because 1204 is already older than the oldest carbon date of 1260, and the cloth that was in Constantinople didn't just get there. It had been there for hundreds of years. So now we know historically that the carbon date is absolutely wrong. And it's there are some references that I think you'll really like, So we go all the way back to the 4th century, and in the 4th century, Pope Sylvester, in the year 325, institutes by a papal decree that the altar where the communion elements are placed must be covered with a long, narrow linen cloth, as if it were the clean shroud of Christ. That's 4th century. Wow. In the 5th century, Bishop Theodore of Mopsuestia of Antioch, a very, very prominent theologian, he says, and this is a catechism that he created for instructions before the celebration of the Mass, and he says that the two deacons who bring that linen cloth and spread it out on the altar represent the figure or the image on the linen cloth at the burial. That's 5th century. And in the 6th century, the Mozarabic Rite of Holy Week, they translate John chapter 20, verse 5. It said, Peter ran with John to the tomb and saw the recent imprints of the dead and risen man on the linens. Those three references alone from the 4th, 5th, and 6th century tell you clearly that this shroud has a history much, much older than the 14th century, as the carbon date will allege.
Yeah,
that's powerful stuff.
Incredible. My guest today, Russ Brialt, if you want to join us, I'll go to the phones in a minute. The number here is 888-914-9149. So we can trace it back, can't we, almost to finding it in the tomb. I know it got lost or hidden for a period of time, right? But there's a pretty definitive history that we can follow across the centuries to bring this back to first century Jerusalem. Plus, there's other evidence on it, like pollen and spores in the fabric that they've studied that come specifically from the Holy Land, even more specifically Jerusalem, right? So do we have a chain of, I don't want to say chain of custody, but, you know, do we have evidence that points it as originating perhaps in Jerusalem and making its way to where it currently is today in Turin?
Well, as you mentioned, there's certainly pollen spores on the shroud from plants that only grow in the Holy Land. It's covered with limestone particles that they're travertine or aragonite limestone that correlate with the same kind of limestone that is found in tombs around Jerusalem. The really interesting piece of data is the fact that your listeners may know that I was in a fire in 1532, kept in a silver box, and the top of the box melted and created this kind of this origami burn pattern that you see on the shroud. So the image lies in between your two parallel lines, of which are nothing more than burns and scorch marks and patches and stuff. But researchers, they were trying to determine how the shroud was folded in 1532 when this fire occurred, and they were able to match up all the burn holes and determine how the shroud was folded in you know, so many layers and stuff. But what they realized is that when they match up the burns, the water stains don't match up. Because you have a whole pattern of water stains on the shroud. And so what we always thought was that the water stains were the result of the fire being doused in 1532, but they're not. They're from something else.
Right.
And they determined by kind of going through and matching up all the water stains and seeing how the shroud would have been folded, the only way that they could replicate it was to fold it in such a kind of a, it's complicated without seeing a diagram, but it was folded in four and then folded like about the size of an album of like an old music album. It was like 48 layers. And then it was rolled and placed vertically in a container. Well, everything else that we know historically shows the shroud in either a flat wooden box, a metal box, or it's rolled on some kind of a roll. But we've never seen it. That we don't have any reference to match what we're seeing here with these water stains. And the only thing that works is that it was kept in a jar of clay.
Wow.
Vertically. That matches exactly the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is how documents were contained or held during first century Middle East. And in fact, the reason that the water stains are visible on the shroud is because of a calcium, deposit of calcium, which comes straight from that clay jar. And that's a fantastic piece of evidence that clearly not only does it place the time period of circa first century, but even the location.
Yeah. My guest today, Russ Brialt. Russ, hold the thought. I'm going to take a short pause. When we come back, I'm going to grab a couple telephone calls for you. If you want to get on the conversation, if you got a question or a comment, we're talking about the Shroud of Turin. Many believe, I'm one of them, that this is indeed the burial cloth of Christ. There's so many mysteries that surround this, and there's so much evidence on it that brings it to the time of Christ in Jerusalem. And there are some scientifically defying, head-scratching evidence on this shroud. I'll talk about some of that when we come back, and we'll take a few of your calls. Feel free to join us. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line.
For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
The image is only on the surface fibrils of the cloth. These fibrils, which are on the order of the size or the diameter of a human hair, these are the fibrils that are twisted together to make threads. If you look, these fibrils are individually colored. They bear that color that is the body image at the microscopic level. Notice that those fibrils are not cemented together by any kind of paint. What we see, and this is the observation microscopically, is that the individual fibrils of the shroud are colored.
To get a better understanding, we need to look at the cloth sideways on.
Get the facts, get the faith. This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Thank you for joining me. If you're just tuning in, we're taking a look at the burial cloth of Jesus Christ. Of course, today we celebrate the resurrection. What evidence do we have of Christ's resurrection? I think there's a lot of it. This particular gift, I think it's quite telling. It shows a crucified man who had been scourged and had been beaten and had been crowned. Everything that the Gospels record seem reflected in this document, if you will, this piece of fabric that has survived the centuries. And you just heard in that piece of audio, I mean, you couldn't create this image today with a laser without scientists knowing how you did it. And I was struck by what the commentator said. Only a single layer of fiber is affected in such a way that nobody can discern. Nobody has that technology. You know, not 50 years ago, not 500 years ago. You know, the overwhelming fact is that no one in the world can explain the technique used to create the image. And for many people, that's enough. They say, hey, this is a gift from heaven. But take it a step further. Even if there was a way, let's say there was some sort of way of inflecting the image in a way that it was inflected, how do you do that in negative? Especially back in the Middle Ages. You got to remember, this garment was created, if indeed that was the case, right, before the invention of the camera. How would you know about creating things in negative, right? I mean, it's a head-scratcher. I love the way God constantly reveals himself to us. So we're learning the same thing on the image of Guadalupe. I mean, after the invention of the camera and computers, we're able to get a look at that, the tilma, and you could see in the eye of the tilma the reflection of the people that were in the room that day. I mean, there's so much mystery to that gift, just as there is the shroud. Those who dispute the shroud, you know, they want you to believe it's a medieval forgery. I think that's a really, really weak argument. There's lots of ways to explain that away. But there's a lot of other evidence, pollen and spores in the fabric, limestone, as we've talked about. What about the blood? That's another aspect of this, too. What about the blood? You know, some say, and we'll get this from my guest, that it matches many of the Eucharistic miracles that have taken place around the planet. I'm joined today by Russ Brialt. He is an expert on the shrouds, traveled the world talking about this. He's incredible to listen to. I'd invite you to go to his website and learn a little bit more about the shroud if you find this interesting. And he's here to take your calls and your questions today. If you want to get in on the conversation, 888-914-9149. Russ, before I go to Jerry or take any other calls, I just want to follow up on how this image was created. You know, they say it was inflected, and there are some, and I haven't even discussed this yet, they say that there must have been a burst of energy. There must have been a release. Like when a nuclear weapon goes off, when the atomic bomb went off in, let's say, Hiroshima or Nagasaki, the image, the shadow almost, of the people that were vaporized end up on the cement wall behind it. And I've seen images where this has been done in other areas as well. The release of energy was so intense. What do we know about how this image got put on this piece of cloth? Some believe it was a release of energy or light. What do we know about the shroud and how is there any explanation for how it may have gotten on there? Again, you know, the technology that had to be used didn't exist from the time this thing, you know, was being passed around. But I'd love your thoughts on that.
Well, it's certainly not a man-made image. And what you alluded to in your intro is there is no visible trace of any kind of paint, ink, dye, pigmentation, or stain. There are no there's no artistic substances on the cloth. So that's really important to keep that in mind, is because there's always the either-or proposition with the shroud. And that is, it either is authentic or it's not. And if it's not, well, then what is it? If it's not authentic, well, then it must be the work of a human effort some way, somehow, either as an artwork or as some kind of a deliberate fraud of some kind. But we can't discern any artistic substance, nor can we even discern a process that this alleged artist used to craft the image. Now, so I mean, that right there poses a daunting challenge to anyone claiming that it's the work of a 14th century artist.
Yeah.
And then, but then the other thing is you do have a pattern of blood stains, which completely correlate with the crucifixion account as recorded in the Gospels, a very distinctive circle of wounds around the head from a crown of thorns, a massive scourging across the body, well over 120 scourge marks to be counted. You have nail wounds in the wrist, nail wounds in the feet. You have a wound in the side that is actually post-mortem, meaning because we see the clear separation of blood and blood serum, and which that would only happen if the blood was no longer circulating, if the heart was no longer pumping, and that's consistent with when that side wound occurred, because they stabbed him in the side instead of breaking his legs because he was already dead.
Right.
And so everything about the pattern of wounds correlates perfectly with the gospel account, but here is the distinction: is that the blood soaks all the way through the cloth, and as do the water stains mentioned earlier, and of course the burns burn all the way through the cloth. But the image of the man is purely superficial; it only affects the top 1 to 2 microfibers.
Crazy.
And if you think that each thread is made up of about 200 microfibers, and that means that this image resides on about 1% of a single thread. I mean, it's astonishingly superficial. And so, I mean, if you were to take a razor blade and shave the surface of the cloth, the image would be gone. And so you have to say, well, what kind of process is this? And it's so to your point, we have been looking at, we understand that the pattern of blood stains is what we would be from the result of direct contact with a body. But direct contact only explains the blood. It doesn't explain the image. And so some other process is at work to understand the image. And you're right, we have been looking at some kind of radiant energy mechanism, be it neutron radiation or light. Now, I mean, personally, I think it's some kind of light. They did some experiments. The ENEA, which is the Italian Agency for New Technologies, these physicists been working with these high power excimer lasers, and they published in a peer reviewed journal in 2011 that a 40 nanosecond. Now, a nanosecond is a billionth of a second. A 40 nanosecond is still, you can't blink your eye that fast. But this microsecond burst on a UV laser against a control sample of linen achieves the very same depth and coloration as we see on the shroud. And I'm saying, well, now that's a cool piece of data, because if you ask the question of what happened to Jesus in the tomb, there's no eyewitnesses. Because it was a big stone put in front of the entrance, and so the only thing you can do is look at other verses of scripture to get an idea of maybe of what happened. And of course you have the Mount of Transfiguration, where Jesus is transformed into a being of light before the crucifixion, right? And then you have, how does he appear to Saul, who becomes Paul on the road to Damascus, but in a blinding flash of light,
right?
And so I think if you just did a straight Bible study and asked the question of what happened to Jesus the very split second his soul came zooming back into that lifeless body, I think you'd have to assume that there was an explosion of light and then gone. Because remember, Peter and John, there was no body there. It was just a vacant linen shroud. And so is this what caused the image? And I think so. I think so. The and of course we can't fully replicate it, but right. There is a real interesting clue in 1 Corinthians 15 where Paul is talking about our future resurrection, and he says, "Listen, I tell you a mystery. We will not all sleep. That means to remain dead, but we will all be changed." For in the twinkling of an eye, we will all be transformed into, you know, and so he's talking about a transformational, instantaneous event in the future. Hasn't even happened yet, and yet this is exactly what happened to Jesus in the tomb. And now why would I say that? It's because Jesus is called the first fruits of the resurrection. If he's the first fruit, then that means we are the rest of the fruit that comes later at the end of the age. And I think that's exciting, you know, because, yeah. You know, the Apostles' Creed talks about we believe in the resurrection of the dead. Well, that's us.
Russ, you know, you said something that struck me, and I'm going to jump into the phones because I want to honor people who are waiting here, about light. And I think you're right about the light. And I've been able to be present for many reported apparitions of the Blessed Mother, the jungles of Africa, in former Yugoslavia, down in South America. And quite often, many of these seers see these visions of the Virgin are preceded by a flash of light. And what the scripture tells us, Christ tells us he is, you know, he is that light, right? It's kind of interesting. I don't know what we'll learn in the future as our technology continues to evolve. We'll have to see, but it's one of the great mysteries of the Shroud. Jerry's in Chicago. He wants to join us. Jerry, thanks for waiting so long. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew. Good afternoon, Russ. Thanks for taking my phone call.
Got it.
Yeah, I just, I've always been struck by John's arrival in the tomb and how he comes to believe, too. And the thing that I always thought of was that, and I wonder if it's true or not, because I don't know the original Greek or whatever language the John's Gospel would have been written in. But he talks about the linen cloth being rolled up in the tomb. At least that's the translation. And the thing that keeps coming back to me is if Mary Magdalene was correct that his body was stolen, the soldiers probably wouldn't have cared about the shroud over the top of him, and they would have just tossed it aside and taken his body out of there. So the fact that it is been handled in a way that is rolled up suggests that somebody was inside the tomb and rolled up the burial cloth.
Well, so to answer your question, Jerry, I don't think there's any reference to the shroud itself being rolled up, but John's Gospel does talk about the napkin that was about his head
was rolled up. Yeah,
placed next to the body.
Okay.
So Jerry.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Okay.
Go ahead, Russ.
No, go ahead.
Assistant. Oh, I'm sorry. I wonder if the treatment of that was consistent with the way a rabbi would treat such a cloth, or there must have been something about the way that cloth was treated that that's something I keep thinking of in terms of what brought John to that belief. It might have just been John.
Well, personally, I don't think John or Peter saw images on a linen shroud. I really don't. I think they saw that cloth in the back of the sepulchre on that slab of rock, and they saw it just as if it had been put there on Good Friday. Nothing moved, nothing changed. It's just now the cloth has collapsed on itself as if the body just disappeared.
Wow.
And that's what they saw, in my opinion. And later they probably discovered, hey, look at this. But I don't think that's what they initially saw. You see, because the image is on the inside of the cloth, not on the outside of the cloth. And so I think it was just the way that it was, how they saw it. And then later, images were discovered, further validating the resurrection, and which is what that Mozarabic rite from the 6th century talks about. It retranslates John chapter 20 and says Peter and John ran to the tomb and saw the recent imprints of the dead and risen man on the linens. Now, that's not in our Bible, but that's how they chose to translate it, and it must be based on information or knowledge that, that existed at that time.
Well, you know, to his point, too, the face covering of Christ, the sudarium, you know, and I know that's on display. Does it have an image inflected on it like the shroud, or you know, what is on that particular garment?
No image. It's the size of a small bath towel. It was just a towel to cover his face because it was a tradition to cover the face of the dead. Plus, it was also to collect blood because blood had to remain with the body. It's a kind of a Jewish law. And it's it was really interesting about the sudarium is that it just looks like a big mess. And it's but we can correlate bloodstain patterns with the shroud. We can correlate pollen with the shroud, with pollen from the shroud. And then but most importantly for me is that what we see on the sudarium is about one part blood and six parts pleural fluid. So in other words, this is fluid in the whole ordeal of crucifixion and having Jesus gone through this massive scourging and everything, his lungs filled up with pleural fluid and eventually died from asphyxia, the inability to to breathe. And so all of this fluid that's in the lungs, once you start taking the body down from the cross and moving it, this stuff comes out of the mouth, out of the nose. It's no doubt it's hard to talk about, but this cloth was there to capture all that and so you can see that it's six parts pleural fluid, which tells you that this cloth was used in a crucifixion, is because that is the cause of death from someone who dies. By crucifixion. And so it's clearly related to the shroud, which is really important from a carbon dating standpoint, because the carbon date wants you to believe it's 14th century, and yet the sudarium has a documented history back to 614 when it comes from Jerusalem to Spain.
Amazing. All right, let's grab a few more calls. Time's going to be the enemy here. It'll go too quickly. Frank is listening in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Frank. Good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. Recently had an exposition of the shroud on tour, not the real, but replica, and all the science behind it, about a two-hour presentation here at one of the parishes in Jacksonville. And the question I posed is to the curator was, why would not the magisterium allow further carbon dating of the actual shroud rather than the reparations that were made back in whatever the 1600s, I guess, 1500s. And the answer that I got failed to satisfy it was because the magisterium wouldn't want to be embarrassed. How is the truth embarrassing? If it was bad science or if it was a bad sample, why wouldn't the truth serve best?
Who gave the presentation, do you know?
I can't remember his name. I can find it.
It was probably me.
Read it to you.
I was just in Jacksonville.
It probably was.
There you go, Russ.
Were you there? Were you there?
Yeah. I was just there. So let me.
That answer left me a little.
Well, let me further explain my answer. The problem with having is people would say, well, why do they only take one sample? Why did they take it from such a lousy location? Well, it wasn't the fault of the carbon labs. It was really, I mean, to be honest with you, it was the decision of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences and Luigi Ganella, the scientific advisor to the Archbishop of Turin. They decided where the cloth would be cut and how many samples would be cut. It would cut in violation of the sampling protocol that had been agreed to. So it was the church's own fault. Is why we have this conundrum at the moment, and the church at large is very nervous about being accused of being anti-science. I mean, here we are on a Catholic radio show, and most of us are in agreement that the shroud is most likely authentic, but there's a lot of scientists in the world who still believe in the carbon date, and the first thing that they would do is to accuse the church of not believing in science, and so it puts them in a box, and so I just don't think they're ever going to do it, not unless they come up with some new technology that allows them to do it without cutting any more samples. You see, because there's a lot of us that say, don't do the carbon date unless you are so vigorous with your protocol that you know, no mistakes can be made.
Yeah, that's my understanding too. Just to follow up on Frank, that you know, they don't want to destroy the image itself. That's why they took it from the side. But as we know, you know, that had been exposed to a fire and it skewed the carbon dating. Maybe there will be technology in the future in which they will, you know, they'll allow it to be retested. Because the one thing the church is not afraid of is science. They've been great defenders of it, and they've led the charge in many areas. Church is all about truth. Russ, I got to take a short pause. When I come back, we'll grab a few more calls, final few minutes of the show coming up. But if you want to join us, we're talking about the Shroud of Turin. And if you're not familiar with that, it's believed very strongly to be the burial cloth of Christ. It holds many mysteries, many of which defy scientific explanation. Yet many believe it's a snapshot of the resurrection. Our conversation continues when I return.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
But a simple look at the image of the face shows that contact between the body and the cloth alone could not have formed the image. The eye sockets and the other recesses of the body, as well as the hair at the side, would never have been in direct contact with the body.
Get the facts, get the faith. This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's good to be with you today. Happy Easter to you. If you're just joining us, we're taking a look at the resurrection of the Lord. Right? And throughout today's broadcast, I did that. If you missed any part of it, simply go to relevantradio.com and go to my show page, the Drew Mariani Show page. And Maggie will have the show up probably about an hour after we're off. And, of course, you can share the podcast with anyone. We took a look at the proof of the resurrection. Now we are taking a look at the burial cloth, that garment, that piece of cloth that was found in the empty tomb. And not only did we have the burial cloth known as the Shroud of Turin now, that's where it's housed, but there was also the sudorium, reportedly the burial face of cloth. It has no image on it, but it does have fascinating blood stains that have been analyzed. And a lot of people wonder, what is the blood type on the shroud? Believe it or not, it's reported to be, and I'll get this from my expert in a second here, my understanding, it's AB. And why is that so interesting? AB occurs only in a very small percentage of the populace. That's it. AB is also the blood type that is found over and over again in Eucharistic miracles that have taken place centuries ago, like that world-famous one in Lanciano, Italy, where the communion host turned into human flesh and the chalice turned into human blood. That was found to be AB. So both tradition and scientific studies claim that the sudarium not only was used to cover and clean the face of Jesus after the crucifixion, but now you got the shroud, you got the sudarium, you've got major Eucharistic miracles, all having the same blood type. What does that say about our Lord's true presence in the Eucharist? My guest today, Russ Brialt, the president and founder of the Shroud of Turin Education Project, been researching and lecturing on the shroud for 30 years. You can find more at his website, shroudencounter.com. Russ, let's start there. Let's pick it up on the blood. What do we know about the blood in the shroud and the connection to so many of these other reported miracles?
Well, you're right. The blood is typed at AB blood type, and it is consistent with all the Eucharistic miracles and is also consistent with the Sudarium of Oviedo, which we were just talking about. And when they did DNA analysis in 1995, they extracted a blood particle from the back of the head, did DNA, and it is human male DNA. And so it is not just blood, it's human blood. And it's And another thing that's interesting about the chemical composition of the blood is that there's evidence of bile and bilirubin and hemoglobin and serum albumin, but bilirubin is a very interesting clue, is because bilirubin is an enzyme that's released into the blood during conditions of severe stress. And of course, I would imagine crucifixion was pretty like beyond stress, and it's so even the blood is characteristic of a man who has been highly traumatized, and it's so I mean that's what the blood tells us.
Yeah, you know, I want to go to the phones, grab a couple calls here. If you want to join us, only a few minutes left, 888-914-9149. Before I do that, though, clear up some misconceptions for me. There's a lot of different things that I've seen over the years. Some say that, you know, when they looked at the shroud, they can actually see coins that were put over the eyes of the deceased, over Christ. And on those coins, they tend to date to the time of the Caesar who was reigning. There was also another study that was done that beneath the beard, they saw some sort of tag. I mean, how much of this is true, and how much is not, and what do we know? I mean,
well, the coins is a consistent thing, but it was popular back in the early 80s. But the problem with the coin images over the eyes is that the alleged coins only show up in 1931 photography, and that's using second and third generation film. So the question is it there or is it not there? And because we can't validate it with subsequent photography, I just stay away from it. I don't think it's a validated proof point.
All right, let's go to the phones. Rose is in Baltimore, Maryland. She's been waiting a while. Rose, good afternoon.
Thank you for taking my call. So I was hoping that we might have an answer whether the blood type being AB is positive or negative. Please.
It's not enough. It's too degraded to tell that. All we can tell is that it is AB.
AB. And what percentage of the population worldwide is AB? Because I happen to be AB blood type.
Well, more significantly, it's what percentage of the Jewish population is AB, and it appears to be somewhere in the 9-10% range.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You got it. Thank you. Good question. So let me ask you about DNA. I mean, now that technology is coming, has there been a DNA profile done on whatever blood sample we have, or they don't have enough of the sample to do that? And I don't know if any other studies been done on it.
In 1995, the DNA was performed at the San Antonio Medical Center, and a whole team of DNA specialists were involved. But the sample that they had was very degraded, and so you could never do a whole genetic, profile on it. But actually it was unauthorized. They were not authorized by the church to do the DNA, and so they got quite upset with that. But authorized or not authorized, we at least now we know it is human male DNA, and it's the church has not authorized any additional DNA on anything. I think there is the fear of unintended consequences that, something sinister may happen. And so they just don't allow it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. My guest, Russ Brialt, if you want to learn more about him, to shroudencounter.com. That is his website, and as I said, he's been researching and lecturing on the shroud for decades now. And if you want to join us, I'll grab a few more calls before we run out of time here. This to me is a mystery that continues to unlock more of its secrets. And I think in the days ahead, we'll continue to learn a little bit more. Let's go to David in Miami. David, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I did a little research.
Hello? I'm sorry, I think we lost him. They go to Dawn in Warwick, Rhode Island. Dawn, good afternoon.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I was recently in Torino, Italy. and I went with a small group of girls. The reason I went to Torino was because I wanted to see my saint, Don Bosco, and Maria Mazzarella, Maria Mazzarello. And so after I prayed at the first church, the Sister of Salesians, I went over to where the shroud is located. And we also went to Fatima. So this was the end of our trip. And I'm praying for a miracle because there's an illness. My son has an illness.
I'm sorry.
A pretty severe one. So we went to the church. Lo and behold, the shroud was not there.
I got to hold you because I got less than 30 seconds. The shroud only goes on display. What is it, Russ, every 10 years or not even that, right?
About there. Next one up is probably 2025.
Okay, so it's a little ways from now. Dawn, I'm really sorry. I got to leave it right there because I am out of time. Russ, I'm going to thank you for being here with me today, too. People can check you out and bring you in to talk, I'm assuming, by just going to shroudencounter.com?
Yep, absolutely.
All right. Dawn, forgive me. David, forgive me. Rose, everyone else on hold who I didn't get to, I apologize. But I'm out of time for the day. You can listen to any of the conversation you might have missed by going to our podcast. Do a search for the Drew Mariani Show. I'll be back tomorrow as we continue to make our way through Easter. It's a joyful time. Until next time, God bless.